All right, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cabot, and I'm the chair of the council for the Northern Region, and I represent non-consumptive, and I'm from Hooper, Utah. I'd like to begin by asking everyone to introduce yourself and who you represent as well as where you're located.
I'm Craig Van Tassel. I'm from Camas, and I represent Sportsman.
I'm Kevin McLeod. I'm from West Haven, Utah, and I represent at large.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
Matt Clark from Ogden, also public at large.
I'm Bruce Silito. I represent the Bureau of Land Management, and I am from the Salt Lake Field Office.
I'm Russ Lawrence. I'm from Ogden, and I represent public at large.
I'm Mike Lauder. I'm from Hooper, and I represent Sportsman.
I'm Kristen Purdy. I'm from Ogden, and I represent non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, Utah, and I represent at large.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife, and I serve as the executive secretary and a non-voting member.
I'd ask that everybody join me in turning off your cell phones, putting them on silent so that we can have an uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of tonight's meeting is to gather input for the public concerning wildlife management policy rules and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board then considers the recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and then sets the policies for all protected species in Utah. The meeting tonight will be recorded, so we ask that everybody speak into the microphone. Those individuals from the public that wish to make any comments or have questions, we ask that you come up to this microphone here, state your name, and speak clearly so that we can get a recording for public record. Everyone should have the agenda for tonight's meeting. Are there any questions or corrections to the agenda? If not, I'd like to entertain a motion to approve tonight's agenda.
I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
It's from Craig, second by John. All in favor? Everyone should have also received the minutes from the last meeting, and I don't have any corrections or anything. I don't know if our past chair did, but if you do, please let us know and we can make those changes to the minutes. Any questions? Okay, a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting. Anybody? John?
Yeah, I make a motion.
Okay.
That we
second? Is there a second? Okay, Bryce, Bruce. All in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
All right, so we'd like to now have the Wildlife Board update, and I think our wildlife supervisor for the Northern Region is going to do that for us, as well as provide us with the regional update.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Robert, our former chair, is in the audience, so if I misstate anything that happened at the board meeting, please correct me. The Wildlife Board ended up adopting all our recommendations, with the exception of our waterfowl recommendation, which was to do away with the split northern goose zone. And they voted in favor of the division's recommendation to stay with the straight early north zone, and then directed the division to essentially go out and gather more public comment about whether or not to split that zone or change that zone. And so there, at the board meeting, there was quite a group of folks on either side of the issue. We had folks that wanted to split it and folks that didn't want to split it, and just based on that turnout, the board didn't feel comfortable making a recommendation at this point in time. So the division is prepared to go out and gather more public input. There's been a survey conducted, and we'll be holding an open house, actually in this location, to discuss that issue on August 6th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. So if you have an interest in joining in on that, please put the August 6th date on your calendar, 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. here at this location. I'd also like to just take this opportunity and welcome our new RAC members. We have 6 new RAC members. I'm not sure if they're all in attendance tonight, but Chad Jensen is our new elected official. He's out of Cache Valley. I don't see Chad here. Matt Clark is our public at large representative. Mike Lauder is our sportsman representative. And Kevin McLeod is also a public at large. And Justin Oliver, who is not here, is our public at large as well. And then Robert Sanchez is our new Forest Service rep, and he was not able to make it tonight either. So welcome aboard, new RAC members. We have 6 new members and a new chair and a new vice chair, so we'll get off to a good start. The other thing I wanted to remind the RAC members of is we do have some training coming up on August 26th. It's the scheduled one-day RAC training, and it'll be held at Shields from 10 to 5. So if you get a chance, put that on your calendar. It's kind of a good training that talks about the RAC process and recommendations in general. The last thing that I want to touch upon at the board meeting is we had a lady come in that was concerned about hunting and trapping around Pineview. This RAC didn't make any specific recommendation to the Wildlife Board, but at the Wildlife Board, they directed the Northern Region to develop some signs and post them around the reservoir, reminding hunters that they need to share that space with the other users. And so we're in the process of developing those signs. They're out for review right now, and we're also going to include a trapping message because this particular individual was concerned about trapping as well. So wanted to pass that along. The other thing is with our new RAC members, I have a membership list here I'm going to circulate during the meeting. Maybe at the break we can pass it over to the other side. Would you just take a moment and review your contact information, the best phone number to get a hold of you, and make sure your email address is correct. Get it back at the end of the meeting. So just quickly, just some updates from the region. Our aquatic section just completed a 7-year project out on Johnson Creek, which is in West Box Elder, to restore a native population of Yellowstone cutthroat trout. And so that project successfully restored 9 miles of stream on public property. So if you've never had a chance to fish for Yellowstone cutthroat trout, that'd be the place to go do it now. There's a pure population there in that stretch of the river or stream. They also conducted boreal toad surveys in West Box Elder County. There's an indication that this species may be petitioned for listing, and so we've ramped up our efforts to gather more biological data on this particular species. Their indications or their sampling show that the population is doing very well. They found toads that were greater than 16 years of age due to the point in time they were marked. They put a little pit tag in the toad, and then they can scan those toads and tell exactly their age and where they came from. So they found one individual that was 16 years of age and at least 2 individuals that had moved greater than 2 miles from the point of marking. It was kind of interesting information. Our habitat section is working with vendors to start the process for approved habitat restoration projects this summer. There are several projects that have been approved here in our region, and they're working towards getting those moving forward. Our wildlife section is conducting their summer rabbit routes over the month of August and early September. They'll also be doing some pronghorn preseason classification work in Box Elder and Rich counties. And then, as a reminder, the archery deer hunt starts on August 15th. In general, deer numbers across the region are up, and so as a general forecast, things tend to be a little drier west of I-15, so deer are going to be concentrated around water west of I-15. But east of I-15, the range looks very lush, and so deer will be at higher elevations and probably spread out quite a bit. So that's all I had, unless there's questions from the rack.
Okay, if there are no questions, let me begin by reviewing the standard operating procedures we have for tonight. The meeting will proceed with a presentation by DWR staff. We will then have questions from the audience, and this is a time for questions only, no comments, at which time then we will move over to the rack, which can ask questions. We will then have a comment period, and so the public will be allowed to make comments on the presentation. If you do wish to make a comment, we ask that you fill out a comment card, one of the blue cards. You can get those in the back, indicating your name and so forth, and the agenda item that you wish to speak to. We will then move over to the rack for comments and then motions for the agenda item. We will begin with our first agenda item tonight, and that is by Leslie McFarlane on the Cougar Management Plan.
I like this podium. You can't see me. So the first thing that I'll go over before we can get into cougar recommendations is the Cougar Management Plan. Over the past 2 years, we were asked to revise it to address concerns. And we were asked by the Wildlife Board to simplify it, make it easier to implement. So, just to give you a little bit of history, evaluations of the genetic relatedness of Utah cougar populations does provide us evidence that cougars do use broad geographic areas across the state and that our populations are interconnected. And Utah cougar harvest has traditionally been controlled in specific geographic areas or hunting units. In 2009, the plan amendments to our cougar plan, so we had a cougar plan that was implemented in 1999, and that plan went for 10 years. In 2009, the first revision to that plan was done. And the amendments in 2009 sought to account for the large movements of cougars by combining units and creating ecoregions so that you could try and control harvest across broader areas instead of in hunting units. And so when you think about cougar management, you have to think that really what we're controlling is hunting in areas for cougars. It's not really covering the biological area that a cougar uses. It's how we manipulate hunting. And so we were trying to use an ecoregion to cover broader scope and areas that cougar use. The problem with this is that it resulted in heavy hunting in some areas and not hunting pressure in the areas that we needed it to be. So easily accessible areas were overhunted, and then areas that were harder to access, nobody went there. So it created this inability for us to kind of control hunting and removal. So the other thing with the previous plan is that it locked in recommendations for 3 years. So when we made recommendations, whatever we recommended lasted for 3 years, and we didn't really have the ability to come in and change. So if we saw heavy harvest in one area, we couldn't come back in and say, we want to alter this because we feel that harvest was too high. So with this plan, we're trying to fix some of those issues. So as part of the other plan too, what happened with the three-year recommendation cycle is that people felt we weren't protecting cougar populations well enough, and so it resulted in female subquotas. And when you had female subquotas, units would shut down really quickly if too many females were harvested, and then you wouldn't get the overall harvest that you needed for an area because too many females were taken at first. And then lastly, in our previous plans, the prey populations were not considered as part of our cougar recommendation process. A separate policy within the division outlined when units would go under predator management. And so with this current plan revision, we're hoping to make changes to all of this. So recommendations will be on an annual basis. We'll consider prey populations when we make our recommendations, and make it a little more transparent when we are using predator management for cougars. So the Cougar Advisory Group is the vehicle that the division chose to work with constituents that had concerns and issues with cougar management in Utah. It was a very large group, and at times it did get quite emotional. But these are all of the members that were asked to participate in the Cougar Advisory Group. Members of the committee included representatives from our agency, Houndsmen Association, sportsmen groups, livestock and agricultural community, non-consumptive users, wildlife services, and then we brought in members from the Mule Deer Committee. The authority of the Utah Cougar Advisory Committee was limited to that of advising the Division of Wildlife on issues and concerns regarding the cougar resource, its use, and impacts on other land uses. The purpose of the committee was to assist us in updating and revising the statewide management plan, and the group was comprised of 20 voting members with one representative from each of the major groups and two representatives from the non-consumptive community. We also asked several representatives that were not part of organized groups from the Houndsmen and the Mule Deer interest to try and get perspective from outside of sportsmen's groups. In total, we had five meetings from December 2014 to April 2015. There were over 50 hours spent on discussion of the management plan and the aspects that went into it. At this time, we wish to acknowledge and thank all of the participants in the Cougar Advisory Group. It was fundamental to developing this plan prior to its approval and implementation. And like I said, there were many passionate discussions, and it's really an emotional issue. So overall, the plan goal itself is to maintain a healthy cougar population within their current distribution within the state, while considering human safety, economic concerns, other wildlife species, and maintaining hunting traditions. Spacing and size of cougar populations in our state is influenced by their social structure. Cougars do adjust their home ranges and territories on availability of areas after individuals are removed from the population. So in general, males tend to travel more than females and have larger territories, and most won't breed until they establish a home range. So based on these type of things, we wanted to make sure that we protected the social structure of cougars. So a couple of the definition of a healthy cougar population is one that maintains a reasonable proportion of older age animals, breeding females, healthy individuals, is in balance with its natural prey, and it maintains genetic variability. So our population management, again, is to maintain cougar populations within their current statewide distribution in a manner that recognizes large geographic and temporal scales, stresses the importance of social structure for long-term viability, directs hunter pressure on a management unit or subunit basis, and manages cougar abundance with respect to their ungulate prey. So there are three different ways that we accomplish harvest in our state. We use harvest objective or quota type hunting, limited entry, and split, which is a limited entry type. It's limited entry until a transition date, and then it goes to harvest objective. So at that time, anybody with a harvest objective permit, and I don't want to talk down, but I know we've got a lot of new members. Do you need me to explain it a little better? Yeah? Okay. So under a harvest objective strategy, what we do is we prescribe a quota or a number of animals that can be harvested from the area. Permits for that area are sold unlimited, and everybody can go into that area and harvest a cougar until that quota is met. They have to call a 1-800 line every day before they go to make sure that the unit hasn't closed. And then once it closed, it's done. They can't go there anymore, and they can go to any of the other harvest objective units. Under a limited entry strategy, harvest is managed by limiting the number of hunters on a unit. So it's the same as a limited entry deer permit or that type of thing. You have to put in for it, you have to draw for it, and those are the only people that go there. It doesn't close down once all of the animals are harvested, although it does because nobody else can go there, but it stays open until the end of the season. On a split strategy, what it does is we have a limited entry drawing, people apply for it, and then it goes to a certain transition date. So all the limited entry people can hunt there until that transition date, and then after that transition date, anybody with a harvest objective permit can go there, or they can take their limited entry permit and go to a harvest objective unit. Any questions on that before I got it explained it well enough. So there are two, within the plan, there are two ways that we manage cougars. There's straight up cougar management, and then there's predator management. So under cougar management, there's no concerns for the prey population. They're doing well. We have no transplants in the area that are going on or susceptible species. There are no concerns with the harvest for the previous 3 years for cougars or anything like that. So that's straight cougar management. Predator management, within the plan, we've defined specific targets or objectives that once those are met, the unit can go under predator management. And so what that means is we just try and have a higher cougar harvest in those areas to help control populations and promote growth of the prey species. So I'll go over the targets specifically for cougar management. The primary target, so these are what we're managing cougars for under cougar management. And again, that means there's no concerns for prey populations or anything else there. Our primary target is to look at so what we'll do is we'll take 3 years of data for each individual unit and average that over 3 years to make sure that we stay below a certain level of harvest for our females. Most cougar populations can sustain harvest rates of 20 to 30% of adult population, depending on the age and sex composition of the harvest. There are impacts to fecundity, density, and age structure when greater than 30% of the harvest consists of adult females. So for these reasons, most states limit female hunting or take to help, unless they're trying to control cougar populations. They'll limit the amount of females that can be taken. Our previous plan had a goal that just looked at adult females in our harvest of 17 to 20%, and we didn't want to exceed that unless we were doing a predator management action. The Houndsman Association and different groups felt that we were kind of discounting the females that weren't breeding or putting into the population yet, and so they felt strongly and requested that we consider all females in the harvest. So the performance target here is to keep total females in the harvest less than 40%. Our secondary target, so our previous plan looked at the reported numbers of cougars treed per day in a survey that was given to houndsmen. Obviously, there can be a lot of bias through surveys and things like that, and so we felt strongly, the group felt strongly about putting in an age objective to make sure that we weren't, to keep kind of keep the social structure for cougar populations in check. And so what the group decided on was to keep the proportion of cougars greater than 5 years old in the harvest to be between 15 to 20%. So if you're greater than 15 to 20%, you've got a lot of older age animals that are being harvested, so you could increase permits. If you're less than 5 years old, less than 15%, then you've got too many young animals in the population, and you probably need to decrease because you don't have the older age class. Does that make sense? Okay. So these are what you'll do is you take each unit, the biologists will take and look at the harvest for cougars for the previous 3 years. If the proportion of females is less than 40%, and the age objective is greater than 20% that are 5 years and older, they can increase permits. If it's right between 15 to 20% on the age objective, then they can maintain, decrease, or increase based on their knowledge of what their unit needs. But that's where you want to be, is 15 to 20%. And if it's less than 15% that are greater than 5, then they need to decrease. Under cougar management, if the proportion of females is greater than 40%, they have to automatically decrease their numbers because they're taking too many females. The only thing that this really, we have a hard time implementing this on, are units with small sample sizes, so like 4 or 5 permits, something like that, because one animal can skew. And so on those units, we're relying on the biologists to know the social issues and the pressures in their area. At that time, they can also select a harvest strategy. Again, that's limited entry, split, or harvest objective. And that's based on the needs of their unit. So for predator management, so before this kind of existed, like I said, in a separate policy within the division. If a deer population, so what we did is we took all of our deer information, all of our survival data and everything else, and we used this to evaluate each of our cougar units. If a deer population is less than 65% of the unit objective the previous year, then it qualifies for predator management. Right now, there are 5 of those. If a deer population is less than 90% of the unit objective and either condition below is met, then it qualifies for predator management. So in order to do this, the adult survival has to be less than 84% for 2 of 3 years and have a declining trend, or the adult survival has to be less than 80% in the previous year and also show a declining trend. Right now, all of our deer units, based on all of our survival data from our models, are showing an increasing trend. So this second part of this, none of our units qualify for predator management for mule deer, except for the 5 that I mentioned before, because their population is less than 65%. We also put in predator management targets for bighorn sheep, and pretty much all of our bighorn sheep management units fall under predator management, with the exception of probably Antelope Island, which doesn't have any mountain lions that we know of, and the Newfoundland Mountains, and probably Zion. The population has to be less than 90% of the unit objective, or the population is less than 125 animals. So most of our bighorn sheep units qualify for predator management. The other part of this is that we can target areas where a transplant or reintroduction will occur within the next year. We can do heavier harvests to try and help make the transplant more successful for any susceptible species, so primarily deer, bighorn sheep, and mountain goat. Okay, so if a unit qualifies for predator management, so it met the targets for deer or bighorn sheep, then what you want to do is control the population. So at that point, you're trying to harvest greater than 40% females because you're trying to influence and bring that population down. So that's the primary target, and that's really all that we look at. We're not looking at age structure in the population, although we are collecting the data. But we're just trying to maintain a higher level of harvest. If the proportion, so to figure out permits and recommendations, if the proportion of females in the unit is less than 40%, then they can increase permits or the quota up to 100%, so they can double it of the previous year. If the proportion of females is greater than 40%, then they should just maintain and not do any increases. And again, they can select limited entry, harvest objective, or split strategy. We do have a couple areas within the state that we consider bighorn sheep management areas. In these units, and so they're the dark green units that are shaded on this map, the primary prey base in these units are bighorn sheep. There are not any appreciable deer populations, so they rely heavily on bighorn sheep or rabbits, that type of thing. They're low elevation. They're pretty much snow-free habitat, and little, if any, cougars are ever harvested in those units. These are open year-round, and there are no limits on the number of animals that can be harvested. They're really hard to hunt, get access in. People don't like to take their hounds into them because they can fall off the cliffs, that type of thing. These units are the San Rafael, the Kaparowitz, and the Book Cliffs rattlesnake. One of the suggestions that came from the advisory committee was to allow people to possess 2 cougar permits on those unlimited quota units and harvest up to 2 animals to try and encourage people to go there. The other part of the plan that we put in was that DWR employees could help remove cougars in those situations. We'll continue to contract with Wildlife Services, and then the ability to contract or authorize somebody outside of the agency or Wildlife Services to go in and help remove depredating animals on those unlimited harvest units. One of the things that really is a new part of this plan that I'm actually really excited about is that we are evaluating our prey populations in conjunction with our cougar recommendations. With the targets, by using the deer survival on the units every year and evaluating that with our cougar recommendations, I believe that we're evaluating our deer population response better in conjunction with our cougar harvest. And so that's one aspect of the plan that I think is a good thing. There are also components to the plan. We didn't make any changes to these areas, but I thought it's important to let you know that these exist within the plan. An outreach and education section that works, that gives us some goals and objectives to increase awareness and appreciation for cougars in our Utah ecosystems. There's also a section in there to deal with chronic livestock depredation, and we did not make any changes to this part of the plan either. This part of the plan is working really well. if a livestock owner has an area where they have chronic livestock depredation, or they are going into an area where they historically have had issues with chronic livestock depredation, they can get a hold of us and we can issue them a permit and they can help solve the problem. One aspect of the plan that was put in is under cougar research. We all agreed that we need to increase our base understanding on cougars in Utah. And we are looking at doing some cougar survival estimates using radio collars coming up in the next couple of years. So in summary, we're recommending that this be implemented as a 10-year plan. With a 5-year, after 5 years, the division will internally do an internal review of the plan to make sure that it's meeting all aspects that we want it to. I do believe that it provides us guidance and direction for managing our populations. Recommendations are simplified. They'll be on an annual basis, and they will occur unit by unit, which is what the board directed us to do. Also within this plan, we're making better considerations for prey populations. And in a second here, the recommendations that I will be presenting will be made in accordance with this plan. And again, I'd really like to thank all of the members of the Cougar Advisory Group for their efforts drafting the plan.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. All right, we'll turn it over to questions for Leslie from the public. Any questions regarding the Cougar Management Plan? Okay, questions from the RAC.
Okay, I have several questions. How do you determine where the cougars are harvested?
How do I what?
Where do you determine, how do you determine where the cougars are harvested?
Meaning units?
I know they have to be checked in, but do you just what they tell you? Or?
Well, so these are, and it's hard to see that on there. So these are the way the units are set up. So they're basically similar to our deer and our elk units. Depending on the color, that's the type of management strategy that we have for that unit. So if it's harvest objective, anybody can go buy a permit over the counter and go hunt in that area. And then we rely on them to tell us where the animal came from. If it's limited entry, then obviously they had to have taken it out of the unit that they had the permit for and that type of thing. But they have to tell us where they got it.
I know there's been talk about using GPS coordinates, and I think that might be good. Other questions, when you're in the plan, you talked about three different habitats, different kinds of habitat, and then you had a range of animals in each one, and it had 100 km squared, or how? What is that in square miles?
I'm horrible at math. Anyone want to convert that? Sorry.
I just, I couldn't put a handle on that, so I don't know.
See if they've got it on their cell phone.
I think it should be close to 2 square miles, maybe a little bit more than that.
What?
A little bit more than 2 square miles.
2 square miles? Okay.
Sorry.
I think it's about 45.
How much?
45.
4 to 5? Okay.
45 square miles.
45? Well, that's quite a bit of difference.
Is that right? Did you say 100 square kilometers, right?
Yeah, 100 km squared.
And so they do use broad areas. The other thing is they don't
38.6.
Recognize. 38.6. How much?
38.6 square
okay,
miles.
Thank
100,
you.
100 square kilometers is 38.6.
I couldn't have done that in my head, so.
Nor could we.
Thanks for saving me.
Okay, I kind of had some questions on how you determine the numbers.
Okay.
You know, how do you come up with, you probably use harvest.
Yes.
And then that talked about a source sink type management. Could you explain that in simple, general what that is? I didn't understand that.
So sourcing gets back to the idea that cougars use broad areas. So in some areas, if you have a high cougar population and you have lower densities in other areas, then the one with high cougar populations serves as a source because those animals tend to migrate out so that they can find territories that they can occupy without another animal being there already. So that ends up being your source, and then your sink is your lower density population. Does that help you? And the way that we establish our numbers, I mean, we've been doing cougar recommendations, I mean, since before the 1999 plan. So we've got a history of harvest in all of these areas, and so it's based on previous year's harvest and where you go up and down.
So it's mostly on harvest then.
Yes.
Any other questions? Chris.
Leslie, I wanted to ask about the three units that you're proposing to be unlimited harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So this is pretty serious predator management on these units. And in fact, if we did not have any cougars at all on those units to benefit the bighorn sheep, this would be, you know, a good thing because we're looking for those populations to increase. So first of all, unlimited, we're talking about any number of hunters can go there. This mm-hmm. is why we're proposing them to be unlimited. I'm also wondering about the second permit that a hunter can get in order to take a second cougar and keep the carcass.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep wondering, is this the dumbest question in the world? I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there an unlimited number of those, of the control permits?
No, and that'll be in my next presentation, so not part of this, but we've kind of worked out how we're thinking that will work. So in order to get the second permit on those unlimited units, because they're harvest objective units, you first have to have a harvest objective permit in your possession. Then you can go and purchase the second permit, and it will only be good on those three unlimited take units.
Right, but we, in this proposal, there's nowhere that says, and there will be this number of control permits offered.
Right, and I think the reason, honestly, I don't think it's going to really help that much.
And that's because these units are so hard to hunt.
They're so hard to hunt, and in out of those three units, one cougar was harvested this last year.
Okay.
I don't have it right here up, but I think it was less than one. I mean, it was one or two at the most.
And how does that compare with the health of the cougar populations on those three units?
Honestly, it's really hard to do because it's such a broad, open area, and cougars are really hard to determine in the area anyway. So honestly, they're probably very low densely populated in these areas anyway. But they don't want them to subsist primarily on the bighorn sheep.
Right. So can I keep going with this, John?
Questions
keep piling up here. Okay, so knowledge of the population base there is not good because it's such a hard units to assess.
Exactly. I mean, I can show you, so few cougars are harvested there anyway, and the ages are vary from very young to very old. And so it's really hard to make a call on how many cougars are in those areas because, for one, the prey base is very low. There's really no way to go into those areas and survey. You can't do track counts or anything like that because there's no snow to base a track count on, plus the terrain and all of that is very difficult to go into. So there's not a real way to get any kind of estimate. In this case, these units are being managed primarily for bighorn sheep and not for cougars, and that's the reason for that right. classification.
So do we have evidence that the cougars are strongly using the bighorn sheep as their prey base?
Yes, there was a research study on the San Rafael that is in the process of concluding, or it concluded within the last year or two, and over 20% of the animals that were killed that were radio collared were taken by cougars.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Other questions from the rack? Leslie, I have a couple. Excuse me. Under the definition you have for a healthy population, you have indicated that there's a reasonable proportion of the population should be older age individuals. What does that mean, and who is deciding whether or not we have a healthy population?
So based on what we, so we've got a history of tooth aging in these populations that goes back to 1999 at least. In the 1999 plan, there was a goal that was requested, that was in the plan that, I can't remember the percentage, but so much of the population had to be 6 years or older. In the 10 years of the life of that plan, that goal was never attained or reached, either for social or management reasons or whatever it be. Going back and looking at all of the data, many of our populations are already at this level for 5 years, between 15 to 20%. And when you look at the ages on a graph, you can see that most of our populations fall within that. And so more than anything, we're just trying to maintain the populations to have at least that level of 5 years old. Breeding age in cougars, a female can breed as early as 16 to 18 months of age, and a male usually 3 to 5 years of age. But it all depends on their ability to establish a territory before they'll start breeding. So if we have at least some level of breeding age animals, we feel that we're protecting recruitment and population status.
I guess my concern is that it's a very vague definition, and I'm wondering if we couldn't have some age proportion of the population with that age category. You said 5 years or something. It's not possible to derive a number that would say 20% or 10% needs to be at that age.
Well, that's what that range is meant to be. So we want 15 to 20% of the animals that are harvested to be to be 5 years or older. If we start seeing it above that, then we know that we've got a lot of older age animals in the population. If your females, if your percent females was really high and your age was really high, then you'd know that you're taking too many older age females and you're affecting the population. So what we're trying to do is say that we want less than 40% to be female, and that we want the age to be between 15 to 20% to maintain that population. But if you start getting too high, then you need to increase, and if it's way too low, then you know you've got too many young animals and you've affected the population. Does that?
Yeah, okay. I guess I was just confused because in the very the definition that you have for a healthy cougar population, not in the management strategies in particular, was fairly vague. But I can see the detail there. So the other question that I have about the plan is in the population management strategies section. Objective 2, and I don't know if you have that listed out, but in there there's a statement that says that when cougar predation is considered a potential limiting factor, then the certain strategies will be enacted and so forth. And I'm wondering, that's also rather vague, and who is deciding whether it's a potential factor and how that's being addressed?
This is under the
It's under the population management section, and it's in objective 2.
So the
of the
predator
plan.
Management part. Show me what you've got.
Right here.
Okay, so that is what that's meant to address.
My concern is this, and that is that, you know, it's vague, and it of course predation is going to be potentially limiting. So, you know, maybe you don't even need that in there, or maybe it needs to be firmed up a bit, because, you know, predation is always considered a potential limiting factor for a population.
The reason that that's vague and that's still in there is with the plan, we're trying to move away from doing predator management plans for each unit, and we're trying to use the plan itself to address our predator management policies. That's actually a holdover kind of from our previous plan, in that if a population wasn't doing well, it would be put under a predator management plan. The reason we left that in there is in case there's a unit that has to be put under predator management, but it doesn't quite meet the targets or the goals of that we've established. And it's supposed to be a kind of like a fail-safe if the plan itself isn't working.
Okay. Any other questions from the RAC? Chris.
Leslie, I'm looking for a couple of other further clarifications on definitions. One of the another items in the definition is to maintain a balance with the cougar's natural prey. Can you define balance? What are we seeking to maintain between the mountain lion and, you know, I'm assuming you're talking about generally this is a mule deer. In exceptional circumstances, it's others.
So when we're referring to, so mule deer are the primary prey in Utah for cougars. So what we're trying to get at here is looking at deer population and survival, and linking that to predator management, so that we're not always punishing cougars if deer populations are doing really well. We want specific targets in place so that that's when you go in and you do an action based on deer populations or based on bighorn sheep. We're trying to put targets in there that, okay, so for example, a deer population that's less than 65% right now is the Book Cliffs deer herd unit. It's consistently really low production. It could be a variety of factors. It could be weather, drought, and all of those things. The thought is if we hold cougars back enough to give the prey population time to increase, then you could reduce the predator management that you're doing because the prey population has time to bounce back. That's the idea behind this, and we're trying to put in specific keys or cutoff points so that we're not always having to come in and do predator management when it may not be necessary. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And also, how do you monitor genetic variability?
We have been doing some DNA work on cougars in Utah. One of the things that we're working right now with our law enforcement is to establish a population base of cougar populations throughout the state. And then some of our research studies also looked at relatedness of cougars that were radio collared across the state. So we've got a baseline that we can compare it to.
Anyone else? Okay, at this time we're going to turn it over to comments from the public, and I will remind you that if you wish to make a comment, that we ask that you fill out a comment card. Those of you that are representing yourself, you'll be given 3 minutes to make your comment, and Bryce will time you. Those representing a group, you will be allowed a 5-minute time period to make your comment. If you wish to fill out a card, please do so and hand it up here, and we'll go ahead and start the process. So the first comment card I have is from Kirk Robinson, and you're representing Western Wildlife Conservancy.
Correct.
Okay.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Kirk.
Thanks for the presentation. I was also on the committee. In fact, I've been on every committee since the 1999 plan. Is that better? All right. In the mid-90s, lots and lots of cougars got killed. Suddenly, almost every western state increased the number of permits, and they whacked them way back. And then after 2 or 3 years of that, they kind of laid off. Same thing happened here in Utah. And I think it might be worthwhile to compare a couple of the performance targets from the 99 plan with the plan now. There were 5 performance targets in the 99 plan. 3 have just been chucked. They're no longer present. 2 have been retained, but in somewhat modified form. One of them has to do with the not taking more than 40% females. The only difference is that now it's measured over a 3-year span instead of each year. And the other one has to do with this age business. In the previous plan, there was a requirement, or a target, rather, to have a 65% or greater adult survival. That has disappeared. I'm not exactly sure why. Instead, all we have now is this certain percentage, 15 to 20% of the individuals 5 years of age or older. In the previous plan, it was a little different. I'm going to read it just to make sure I get it correct. The percent of animals in harvest over 6 years, not 6 years and over, but over 6 years, that would presumably be 7 and above, would be 15% or greater. So this is the one target, by the way, that gave me the most angst as a member of the committee. That's why there's an asterisk by my name. No sufficient rationale was ever given for this, in my opinion. I'm willing to argue the case. I know some people will probably disagree, but we could look at the research. And this plan and all such plans are supposed to be based on the best available scientific research. There's a lot of research coming out of Washington in the last decade, and some coming now out of Colorado, that suggest that you really ought to maintain a truly broad spectrum of ages. You need to have quite a number of the older toms out there that have a fixed home range and can defend it. They regulate the cougar population because they will kill the young toms that come in to try to take over if they can, and they usually prevail. And so that's one reason, besides prey availability, why cougar populations are self-regulating, unlike deer populations and elk populations, for example. So the Washington folks recommend not taking more than 14% of the adult population each year. Somehow this literature was never provided to the committee. It was never really even discussed. So that's one of my misgivings about the plan. There are a lot of good things about the plan. The simplicity of it, yes. But it's not only simple and vague. It's that allows almost total discretion to DWR to do whatever they want, in my opinion. I think that this is a problem with this plan, frankly. And that's why I'm going to watch it closely, and a number of other people are, too, down through the years, to make sure that the young population that we have, our cougar population is pretty young. It's something like 37 months. It's not a very old population. That's the average. That it doesn't go lower. And one of the problems with having young, predominantly young animals in your population is they're the troublemakers. This is one of the findings that Beausoleil and Kohler and others in Washington discovered. They're the ones that don't have fixed territories or well-developed hunting skills. They're the ones, more often than not, that get in trouble with killing people's pets, venturing into suburbs, and so forth. So there's a safety issue here at stake, too. Another thing is, these predator management plans, at least as applied to mule deer, cannot be supported by the best available science. The best available science tells us that you cannot even detect any correlation between how many cougars you kill unless you wipe them all out and deer populations. There's almost no Well, there really is no statistically significant correlation. This was borne out in a long-term study in Idaho and more recently in Colorado. So I just want to say that I think that for all of its virtues, and I have to give Leslie a lot of credit for making a big effort here, I still think this plan has a long ways to go. It will all depend on how it's actually implemented. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next I have is Brett Selman, representing Utah Wool Growers and the Farm Bureau.
I'd like to thank you all for your time. My name is Brett Selman, live in Tremont. I'd like to thank you guys on the rack for your time to listen to us. I'd like to thank Leslie for all of her time. I sat on the advisory board as well. As was mentioned, we spent a lot of time working this plan. It's not perfect. You know, there's nothing that could be perfect that would satisfy everyone, but it's a middle ground that we can all come to, I believe. We had a lot of representation from a lot of different groups. I like the fact that the deer are taken into consideration. You can't have a predator without prey. I can't run sheep without grass. It has to be hand in hand. We have to be able to feed these animals, and they have to be able to, and we're managing people here. We're managing the people that want lions and some of us that want a few less. We're managing the hunters that hunt them. So it's a very complex thing. And I was asked by the Farm Bureau to stand in support of this plan. They couldn't be here, and I am the wool grower representative of this plan, and I stand in support for the Utah wool growers of this plan, and it's something going forward that we can make work, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Brett. I have a card from Tyler Farr. Didn't indicate which specific agenda item you wanted. Did you want to talk about the plan?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. And you're representing the Utah Houndsmen.
So I'm from Tyler Farr. I live just outside of Ogden. I'm on the board for the Utah Houndsmen Association, and I'm representing the club tonight. As a club, we want to thank Leslie, and we know that our president, Dan Cogcane, he's really happy with Leslie and all the time that she's put in and for this plan. On the board, we drafted this letter that we wanted to read here tonight, and I'll just read it for you. It says, the Utah Houndsmen Association supports the recommended cougar management plan, and we ask you to vote to accept it as it is written. The Utah Houndsmen Association supports the Division of the Wildlife Resources 2015 to 2016 cougar harvest recommendations with the following exceptions. So we have two concerns here that we've gathered from club members across the state, and they've asked us to support them in this letter.
Do you want to do your recommendations when we do the actual recommendation part? Not to interrupt you, but
is that when I'm supposed to do it? Then I'll do it then.
That'd probably be helpful.
Okay,
we just focus on the plan now, so we'll put your card back in the stack for the recommendations.
Sorry, Dr. Kevin.
No, that's fine, Leslie. Any other comments from the public? If not, then we'll turn it over to the RAC. Comments on the management plan. Craig.
Yeah, I have one comment. I'm not a big fan of harvest objective, and I think it needs to be in the plan. It needs to be a tool, but I just think if conditions are right, you can over-harvest. You can harvest more females than you want or more younger cougars than you want, because sometimes you'll tree an animal and you don't know if you can hunt tomorrow, so you'll take that animal rather than hunt later and maybe get a more mature animal that you're more targeting. So I just would like to make that comment. I think limited entry is the best way to go, but I think you need to split. I like splits because that gives hunter opportunity, and I think we need to have hunter opportunity. And I just want to just say that I think harvest objective ought to be the last option. That's just my opinion.
Okay, thanks. Any other comments?
Mike. Just like it, public knowledge that I was on the advisory committee. I was told that it would be a good idea to mention that prior to or during discussion items. So.
Okay. Other comments? Okay, if not, then the chair would entertain a motion on the management plan.
Make a motion.
Bryce?
Make a motion that we accept the plan as presented.
Second, John. Okay, so the motion on the table is to accept the Cougar Management Plan as presented, with a motion by Bryce and a second by John. Okay, so all in favor of the motion, raise your hand and signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Okay, so it's unanimous. All right, next item on the agenda is the Cougar Recommendation and Rule Amendments for 2015 and 2016. Leslie?
You guys get a lot of me tonight, sorry. There are copies of the recommendations that I just gave to Jody. I'm sorry, I forgot to put them out before the meeting, so. Okay, so just a little bit of history on our cougar harvest in Utah. Our cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry hunting since 1999. Before that, it was unregulated. You could just get a permit, go wherever you wanted. Under the limited entry hunting scenario, like Kirk referred to, there was a dramatic increase in the number of permits and harvests in the mid-1990s. That was a west-wide focus on cougars in particular. In 1997, we switched and added additional harvest pressure by implementing the harvest objective quota system. And during that year, a record high of 1,496 cougar permits were sold. Since 2000, we average about 327 limited entry permits and an average quota of 254. This past season, we offered 460 permits. 253 of those were limited entry split strategy. 207 of those were offered through the quota system. Total sport harvest was 330, and we had a 45% success rate for limited entry and a 68% success rate on harvest objective units. Total harvest, including wildlife services, nuisance, roadkill, that type of take, was 345 this past year compared to 376 the previous year. And like I said earlier, the important thing for us to keep track of management-wise for cougar populations is the proportion of females that we take in relation to males in our harvest. And so when you look at these lines, total sport harvest is the top line. Male harvest is the darker gray line, and then female harvest is the dark brown line. When you have concerns is when your two lines are actually meeting and your female harvest is meeting your male harvest, then you're really having an impact overall. So this is statewide, and you can see that in the 90s, and then again in 2004, we were taking a lot of females. But right now, we're about where we want to be with a split in males and females, and they're not equaling each other. So our current performance target established in our cougar management plan is to keep the proportion of all females in our harvest less than 40% within a management area averaged over 3 years. Statewide, the percent total females in the harvest for the past 3 years is at 35%. This includes all of the units that are under predator management. And our percent adult female, and our percent adult female, or all female, adult females between 22 to 25%. And that's adults only. Of course, each individual unit, the number varies by each individual unit, and that's what each biologist looked at when they made the recommendations, is the data for their units. So our cougar population is monitored through mandatory reporting of all hunter-harvested cougars. If we have cougars that we pick up as roadkill on highways or accidents or nuisance take, we record all of that as well, and that's included in our harvest numbers. When we get a hunter-harvested animal or Wildlife Services take animal, we record the location of kill, the sex, and then age. And then the age estimation is also verified, or we try and verify it through cementum annuli of a tooth that's taken from each animal. And so, like I said earlier, the effect hunting has on cougar populations depends on the level of harvest and the sex and age of the cougars that are removed from the population. Females can breed as early as 16 to 21 months, but most research indicates that it's about 26 to 30 months. And the difference is related to them and their ability to establish a territory. Males reach breeding maturity about 24 to 30 months and usually get resident status at about 36 months. Females can live for greater than 10 years in the wild. And like we mentioned earlier, the plan in 1999 had an age objective of 6 years or older at 15% or greater in the harvest. The problem with the previous plan is that in the 10 years the plan was in effect, that age objective was never reached. And so that's one of the discussions that we had on the age objective in the meetings, was that we wanted something that would maintain populations where they currently are without huge increase or decrease. And so that's why we selected 5 based on what the populations in Utah currently were at. In subsequent versions of the plan, the age objective was dropped because the goal was never obtained. And they went with treed per day as a value. In the absence of other population status indicators, and Kirk mentioned that they used a 65% survival estimate on cougars, we have a really hard time getting at the accuracy of that number. And so one of our research proposals going forward is to radio call our cougars, similar to what we do with our deer survival estimates, and use the survival from those radio collared cougars to then go into a model so that we can try and estimate populations, and then we'll try and add that into the plan in the future. So right now, in the absence of all of those other factors, we're relying on age as one of our objectives. And you can see here, in 2013, about 33% of the animals that were in the harvest statewide were 5 years and older. This year it's at 23. One of the other things that we look at in each of our units is the amount of livestock depredation that occurs across the state. Since 2001, we've paid $907,000 out on livestock that have been confirmed killed by cougars. In 2013, there were 46 incidents. $68,000 was paid out for cougar depredation. and a total of 18 cougars were removed. We're currently in our livestock depredation season right now, so I don't have final figures on that. For this past year, we paid out $148,000 for livestock depredation. 44,000 of that was for cougars, and we had 34 claims with 241 confirmed losses. It is down from previous years, but it does have a slight increasing trend in the number of animals removed. And Darren. I'm going to have Darren present regional recommendations for you guys.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Darren DeBlois. I'm the regional assistant wildlife manager. I don't think it goes any higher.
Before he gets going, let me explain the color coding on the chart here. So yellow, so as you read over, the name of the unit's on the left. The second column over is whether or not that unit qualified for predator management in accordance with the Cougar Plan. So anything in yellow means it's under predator management, and then the species and that it's under predator management for are listed in the yellow box. The permits and quota that were issued last year in the next column, the percent females for that unit, and then those that are greater than the percent greater than 5. And then if it's green, it means an increase. If it's orange, it means a decrease from the previous year. And then the strategy, if it's white, it's a change in recommended strategy from the previous year.
Okay, I'll just kind of go through them one by one, but everybody can look and see. So box elder desert is a bighorn sheep and deer. Primarily bighorn sheep predator management plan in place, but we're not recommending increase in permits at this time. Box elder pilot mountain is that far west unit next to Nevada. We are recommending an increase of 2 permits on that unit to address bighorn sheep and deer concerns. Raft rivers, no change, but it is under predator management. Cache is not under predator management. We are recommending an increase of 5 permits on the cache, and that's due to our 21% 5 years or older, and we're under 40% females, so we feel like we can increase on the cache. Chalk Creek Camas remains the same. East Canyon, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits, and East Canyon Davis is a subunit of that larger East Canyon unit that just encompasses the front, and we're recommending that stay the same. Morgan Southridge, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits, and Ogden, we're recommending a decrease of 1 permit, primarily due to the over 40% females in the harvest. The 2 changes in strategies that you can see, we're recommending that Box Elder, Pilot Mountain, and Ogden go to a harvest objective unit hunt strategy, and all the rest remain the same.
Okay, thank you. Is that all? All right, any questions from the public regarding the presentation?
Oh, I'm not done.
Oh,
then.
I'm sorry.
We're done with Darren.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Leslie.
Okay, so then each region, and I don't know specifically what concerns for other regional recommendations there will be here, but I'll just touch on the highlights or the changes. Probably the biggest, most controversial change that I can see coming up through this process will be the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit in the northeastern region. That unit does qualify for predator management. It only has a 56% survival on its deer herd. And the percent females in the take is less than 40%, and we have a really high, greater than 5-year-old age average in that unit. So the region is recommending an increase from 20 to 38. The other units there, the only other increase is on Wasatch Mountain's Current Creek. There's only a 7% 7% of the animals that have been harvested there have been females, and 46% of those animals are greater than 5 years or older, so the region feels that they can increase a little bit on their cougar harvest. As far as the other regions go, the central region is recommending a decrease in the number of permits on the Northwest Manti, primarily because it's not under predator management, and the percent females is greater than 40%, so they're decreasing by one. The Central Mountain Southwest Manti is also recommending a decrease because the percent females is at 42%. The Ochre Stansberry is recommending an increase of three. We have the percent females is at 17%, and the age greater than 5 years old is at 53%. They've also had a lot of depredation on their radio collared mule deer, and so they're trying to work on some of their depredation issues there. Also, the Ochre Stansberries is under predator management for bighorn sheep on the Stansberries. The biggest change probably for the central region is to go from split, I believe, on Central Mountains Nebo, Nebo West Face, Northwest Manti, Southwest Manti, to limited entry. And the West Desert Mountain Ranges to go to harvest objective, and then the West Desert Tinnick Vernon to go to split. I believe it was limited entry. Southeastern region had no recommended changes to their strategies or their recommendation or their permit numbers, and so they're going to be status quo as they were last year. So the one thing that we mentioned in the plan was to allow the ability for somebody to have possession or purchase two cougar permits. This is on the unlimited quota units only, so the darker green areas. In order to get a second permit, you have to first have a harvest objective unit permit, and you use that or a split permit after the transition date, you can purchase the cougar control permit. The control permit will be valid only in the unlimited quota units, which are the Book Cliffs rattlesnake. There's a boundary change suggestion coming up right here in just a second to add the 9 Mile South to that, the Kaparowitz and the San Rafael. Just to kind of show you numbers for the previous years, in 2015 we issued 253 limited entry permits. This year we're recommending 243. Our largest increase comes in objective totals from 207 to 249. Overall, it's an increase by 32. Like I said, there was one request for a boundary change to add the 9 Mile, to create a 9 Mile North unit to take out the 9 Mile South, which is this lower portion, and add that to the Book Cliffs Rattlesnake Unlimited Take Bighorn Sheep unit. And this is primarily because it's bighorn sheep that are mostly there. There's few deer that are in this area. And it's really inaccessible, and so they're trying to combine that with the Book Cliffs Rattlesnake. One other boundary change, and this is just for consistency's sake, is to the Ochre Stansberry and the West Desert Tintic Vernon to make it consistent with mule deer boundaries. Cougar season dates, we're recommending limited entry be from November 11th through May 31st. The split season would be November 11th through February 26th, with the transition for to harvest objective occurring on March 3rd and go through May 31st. Harvest objective season, we're recommending November 11th through November 6th of 2016. The unlimited quota units would go November 11th through November 10th because they're open year-round. And then the pursuit season, we're recommending that be from November 11th to May 31st. So in summary, the recommendations in this plan are in accordance with the Cougar Management Plans. All females were considered in our harvest. The age performance target was an extra measure on populations. Our recommendations, again, will be annually on a unit-by-unit basis. It incorporates our pre-population performance into our cougar recommendation. This will allow for evaluation of predator management on an annual basis, and it really overall did not result in a significant increase or decrease in permit or quota recommendations. Now we're done.
Now we're done. Okay. Thank you, Leslie. Do we have any questions from the public regarding the presentation?
Thank you, Kirk Robinson again, Western Wildlife Conservancy. Leslie, I noticed with the harvest objective that there are 42 more permits net this year than last year. And I'm surprised about that because my understanding was that the number of predator management units would go down, and typically predator management units are managed by harvest objective. So I know that it's just a matter of looking carefully at the numbers, but I can't compute that quickly. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind just sort of explaining how they actually went up.
So so it's not permits, it's quota. So the quotas were increased on the harvest objective units, and most of those are bighorn sheep units.
So it's because of bighorn sheep?
Yes. Yes.
Any other questions?
John Larson with SFW. Leslie, it's good to be here with you. Just a quick question regarding those units that can harvest two lions. What units were those again? Could you repeat that for me?
So it'll be the Book Cliffs Rattlesnake with the new addition of the 9 Mile South, the Kaparowitz, and the San Rafael.
Sheep units as well. And then one question for you. San Juan does not make that list. Is there a reason for that?
It was never identified originally. These have already been identified through previous meetings as unlimited take units.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Okay, turning to the RAC, are there any questions for Leslie regarding the presentation? Bryce.
Wasn't a lot of the increase on the Book Cliffs, so I mean that doesn't reflect sheep, that's more for the deer.
Yeah, I missed
20 of the tags. So I mean that does a huge
right, sorry.
With the deer.
I should have remembered the Book Cliffs. But yeah, that 18 of those were for deer on the Book Cliffs. Sorry, thank you.
Any other questions for Leslie from the RAC? Okay, moving to the public for comment. Remember, we need a comment card. We have Tyler Farr, who's going to comment on the recommendations and rule amendments.
Yeah, and once again, I'm representing the Utah Houndsman Association Club. Yep. Our club had two recommendations to the permit and quota recommendation here, and the first one was, you brought it up, was the Book Cliffs. Last year there was 20 permits take, there was 20 lions, that was the quota, was 20, and it jumped 90% to 18, and that's a big concern for the houndsmen, and mostly to the houndsmen that are in the Vernal Roosevelt area, because the Book Cliffs is a little different than the San Rafael and those unlimited units, because there's no roads in there and there's no snow. Well, the Book Cliffs is opposite. There's snow and there's roads everywhere. So that makes an alarm for us because we have a good feeling that it will be filled. Because if a lion moves a few miles in a night and it crosses snow, it's going to get caught and the odds are it's going to get killed. So we'd like to reduce that from 90% increase to to 25%. That's our first recommendation. The second one is we had a few club members in the central south region that were nervous about the Monroe unit because of the lack of age that's been harvested on the unit. If you notice on Leslie's little chart here, on the Monroe unit, over the last 5 years, only 7% of the lions harvested were over 5 years old, and that's really low. And a lot of our club members would like to get that moved from a split to a limited entry to help that unit provide a quality trophy hunt. And that's all the recommendations we have.
Okay, thank you, Tyler. Okay, John, is it Larson?
This is too high now, but we'll make it work. Good to be with you. Again, I want to take a minute and thank Leslie and the committee for all their work on this effort and this plan as well. We know, you know, there's a lot of time and energy that gets spent in doing these, and to get a group of individuals to come to any consensus on wildlife in Utah is a pretty big deal, so great job there. As a group with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, we do accept the plan as presented, but we do have a few suggestions for you and recommendations as well of our own. I met last night with several of our chapter leaders from across the state to discuss recommendations here, and I'm just going to read the following. There's quite a few of them, so be patient with me, please, as I read these. But starting with the Pine Valley, both north and south, we'd like to see that change to a harvest objective year-round. On the southeast Manti, we'd like to see the tags increase from 10 to 15. And the rationale for that, that's a large increase. But the rationale for that, and listening to our membership and several of the hunters that live in that area and hunt that area, they're just not seeing the mule deer. It's well below population objective right now. It's probably lower than the 35%.
Which unit?
Southeast Manti. While she's pulling that up, that's a grave concern, and you know, I don't know that cougars are the issue, but they eat deer, as do coyotes and all predators. So it's just an issue and a great concern to our membership that you go down there, and whether you're horn hunting or whether you're hunting in general, your outdoor activities, they're just not seeing the mule deer in that country. And again, it's well below population objective.
So the issue on the Southwest Manti, and the reason that it's not under predator management, is in the previous year it was at 66% of objective, so it doesn't qualify. It needs to be less than 65 in accordance with the plan. The other part is that it has to be less than 90% of objective in the previous year, and then it has to be less than 84% for two of the 3 years, but then it also has to have a declining trend. And all of our deer populations right now have an increasing trend, so that kicks it out of predator management.
Totally understand that. That's not the issue, actually. The issue is, I mean, the scientific data is great, but the deer, they're not seeing them. Our membership isn't seeing them. So that's the problem for us. I'm not saying it has to be in a predator management plan, but you do need to watch the predators there, which is why we're asking for the decrease. Again, it's right there at the cuff at the 65%. So I think it deserves to take a look at that. You know, the mule deer population in the state is great. It's rebounding. It's coming up. But you still have those pockets you have to protect, and you got to watch those areas. In addition to that, on the Pavant, looking at that area, the recommendation is to take that from 9 permits down to 8. We'd actually like to see it go to 10, and the reason for that is we've spent a lot of money to translocate mule deer to that area. So to increase, or to decrease the permit there, despite the work we're putting in there and the money involved to move those deer as well, it just seems counterproductive to our group. As well as that, on the Southwest Manti, from 6 to 8 tags rather than 6 to 5. Same reasoning on the Southeast Manti, just not seeing the animals there. And then the last one for us is Mount Dutton. We'd like to see that increase to 15 tags rather than the decrease. That's another area where we've transplanted mountain goat and spent a lot of money doing it. So
to us, it seems counterproductive in that regard.
And the reason that you see those decreases is it's in accordance with the plan. So on Mount Dutton, it doesn't qualify for predator management for bighorn sheep or mule deer. It doesn't meet the targets. And it was 60% females in the harvest, with 25% of those being over five. So the region chose to decrease because it's outside of the plan if we do different. What was the other one you had?
That I was just referring to Mount Dunn.
Okay.
On the goats.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
John.
You.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Any other comments from the public?
It's on my card.
Okay.
Six.
Okay, yes, I'm sorry. I missed that. Go ahead, Kirk.
Okay, thank you. Kirk, once again, Western Wildlife Conservancy. Couple of things. First of all, you can see how controversial this kind of topic is. You got people interested in cougars because of their interest in hounding as a sport, others because of their interest in hunting deer or elk. In my case, I'm pretty much just interested in cougars when it comes to cougar plans. What's good for them as a population? And what is their role in the ecosystem? And the fact is, DWR never really seriously tried to meet that previous performance target. They never tried once. I kept bringing it up over and over again. And the fact is, what they eventually did was just decide to lower the bar. No particular effort was made to try to achieve more older individuals. Trust me. I would be happy to be corrected if there's something in the record anywhere that indicates otherwise, but I sincerely doubt it. One other comment I want to make. I'm really happy to see the division and Leslie stick to what the plan actually dictates, even if I don't necessarily agree with the plan. You know, if the plan has a cutoff here or there, you can't make allowances just because some group says we're not seeing the deer out there that we would like to see. I don't think that's legitimate. But when it comes to predators and prey, and in this case, cougars and deer in particular, I know it's counterintuitive to think that cougars are not making an impact on the number of deer. It's very counterintuitive because, as the gentleman just said, cougars eat deer. But the fact is, many factors affect the population of deer. And climate and nutrition availability as a result of climate is by far the main one. Severity of winter, drought, and other things play into that disease. The studies that have been done recently, very sophisticated long-term studies, have not been able to detect a cause and effect relationship between removing cougars and increases in deer herds. It's just a scientific fact to the best that has been determined to date. You can say whatever you want, just look at the studies. And if you're interested in them, I will send them to you. Just contact me. There was one done in Idaho here, published in 2011 by Hurley et al., 10-year study that showed this. Another one by Bishop in Colorado. Kenny Logan in Colorado is doing something along these lines as well, I believe. But we have to get over the idea that it's cougars that are getting rid of our deer. It's not cougars. It's habitat changes for a variety of reasons. One of them has to do with climate change. One has to do with more roads, more subdivisions, more summer homes, more highways. We really ought to concentrate on fixing those problems as much as we can, and let the cougars be cougars. You know, a natural balance between cougars and deer was what there was when we left them alone. You know, they take care of themselves. Cougars limit their own population. They don't need us to do that. They follow the deer population, fluctuate with the deer population, which in turn changes with respect to the available nutrition. That's the way it works. And again, I'd be happy to send you the latest studies from various states that will corroborate this, if you're interested. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kirk. Okay, comments from the RAC. Craig?
I don't have a comment, but I have a question. Is it okay if I ask a question?
Yeah.
Do cougars prey on a Rocky Mountain sheep?
Yeah. Yes, they do.
How much?
How much do they prey on Rocky Mountain sheep? Depends on the area. Some of the research shows that it depends on each individual cougar. Once they learn to specialize on a specific species, then they can have detrimental impacts to that species. I couldn't tell you how many they take, but yeah, they will. And that, so if you look at the Northeastern region recommendations, all of those sheep units are Rockies.
I meant to say Rocky Mountain goats.
Yeah, they can. I don't know how much they do, though. On the last transplant, I believe 2 of the goats that were radio-collared were taken by cougars.
Any other questions or comments for Leslie from the BRAC?
I've got one. Leslie, I just wanted to tell you, I appreciate you following the plan, and you know, we all have little concerns here and there, but I like how the plan is dictating, you know, what you do. So I appreciate that.
Thanks, Russ.
Any other comments or motions? Bryce?
I got a comment, too, that she's done a great job. I know last time we had this, she took a lot of bullets and got beat up pretty good. So it's nice to see, you know, the houndsmen and the hunters kind of getting along, I guess, and not too much. And usually this audience is packed with people, so kudos.
Thank you.
Okay, motions. Russ.
I move that we approve the recommendations made by the division on the cougar recommendations.
And rule amendments.
And rule amendments, yes.
Second? Craig? Okay, so we have a motion by Russ and a second by Craig to approve the cougar recommendations and rule amendments for 2015 and 2016. All in favor, say aye. Raise your hand. Okay, it's unanimous. Okay.
You're not done with me yet.
Number 7, fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations for 2015 and 2016, Leslie.
Stay for the bobcats.
Okay, so first I'll talk about bobcat harvest. This past year we went from, so we had 3 years where we had a cap on the number of permits that were sold to an unlimited number. And we sold 13,475 bobcat tags. Our harvest was 2,919 bobcats. Our total trap harvest was 2,776. Incidental take was 78, and total non-trap harvest was 143. Our total number of trappers usually averages around 941, and the number of hunters that pursue bobcats averages 388. This past year, we had an increase to 1,105 trappers and 305 hunters for a total of 1,410 individuals pursuing bobcats. One of the important things, when we removed the cap on the bobcats, there was concern that the harvest would greatly increase. And I think it's important to note that there was not a significant increase in the number of bobcats that were taken. And part of this has to do with the ability of the people that bought tags to trap them and know how to trap them. So although we increased a great amount, we didn't see the number of set days per bobcat did increase significantly, and that's just because you had a lot of people that didn't know how to do it out there participating. So the bobcat plan, we have a bobcat management plan, and it uses performance targets to adjust permit numbers and season dates. So the variables that you look at are the percent young that are in your harvest. The target range for that is 42 to 56%. Percent adult survival, the target range for that is 65 to 72%. The percent females in the harvest, the target range for that is 41 to 45. And the last variable there is set days per bobcat. We want that to be between 177 to 220. So based on the, so I've got several years here. I've got 2012, 13, 14, and then the last column is our season this last year. Our percent juvenile was at 60%, so that's a little higher than the target range of 42 to 56. Our percent survival was also higher, which it's in the good way, so it was at 74%. Our percent female was at 45%, so right on the fringe there, and our set days per bobcat was 373. Out of all four of these variables, this is the only one that's not biologically based, and so it's the least reliable metric to base increases and things like that on. Because, like I said, it depends on the experience of the person out there trapping, and if they're less experienced, obviously it's going to take them a lot longer to catch a bobcat, so that makes that number go higher. The way that the plan's written is that you have to have a net of two of these performance targets if less than two of them are out. Side of the range, then you return to baseline. And so this is kind of difficult to explain, but the percent juvenile and the percent survival actually cancel each other out. So the only one outside of range would be set days per bobcat. Do you guys get that? Okay. And so less than two of the performance targets are outside of the range, so we return to our baseline recommendation in accordance with the plan, which is to allow each individual to purchase six tags, and we're recommending the season, and the rest of baseline is that the season runs from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February with no cap on the number of tags that are sold. One thing that I just want to show from last year, there was a request that was approved through the RAC and the board process to add a week to the end of the bobcat season. And I just want to show that that extra week, which is week 13, just resulted in a higher male take versus female take, and we'll probably be looking at switching some of our season in the future so that we're harvesting more males than females in the future. So we'll be looking at maybe changing, recommending some changes to our season dates in the next, the bobcat plan expires this year, so we'll be looking at that over the next year. So again, our recommendations this year, six permits per individual. In accordance with the plan, we're recommending the season run from November 18th to February 7th with no cap on the number of permits that are sold. Along with this, I need to make recommendations for our other fur bearer season dates, and they're consistent with our previous years. Beaver and mink, September 26th to April 6th. Badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel, September 26th to February 7th. Marten, September 26th to February 7th as well. There's one other change, and this has to do with trapping of muskrats on waterfowl management areas. In the past, it's been kind of a drawing type system, and there's about 30 to 40 people that put in for this every year. And what it is it's a management action. We use trappers to go in on our waterfowl management areas to remove muskrats that do damage on dikes, get into our nests, and all of that type of thing. So it's to protect nesting waterfowl. It's not a recreational opportunity, but there have been a lot of complaints in the past that the system that we had, the drawing type system, wasn't fair. And we're trying to look at it more, getting more experienced people out there so that we get the muskrats removed. So we're recommending a rule change to the fur bearer rule to allow us to collect proposals from the public and select the proposal with the greatest benefit to the division and sportsmen, so it becomes like a bid process. They have to have, in order to bid on it, they have to have trapping experience. One of the things we'll rate is their familiarity with the WMA and then their ability to come and do the work and actually be on the WMA. And it can be monetary or in-kind service. And that's what I have for you.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. Questions from the public? Okay, questions from the rack? Comments from the public. We have a couple of cards. Stan Bassett.
My name's Stan Bassett, and I'm just representing myself. In regards to the waterfowl management units, I think it's really important that you require the people to have a trapping license, and possibly that the title should be changed instead of muskrat trapping, just to trapping. Because I've trapped those for a lot of years, and you have to trap actual fur bearers that require a license, beaver, mink, weasels, and whatever else they say. And so, anyway, that would be my recommendation for that, and that's, I think, would be pretty important.
Thank you. Kent Fountain?
Is this comment or recommendation?
This is comments. It's the same thing.
You want to do it now.
Mr. Chair, members of the RAC, we appreciate your time. I'm Kent Fowden. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. We appreciate the time and effort that's gone into this. And we, as a whole, support the recommendations. There is two caveats. One would be in regards to the length of the season. We were given an extension of a week last year, and part of that was for...
For what species are you referring?
Bobcat, okay. Sir. Part of that was to prove a point that toward later in the season we get the more harvest of mature toms, and that's starting to prove out. We would recommend or ask that the RAC vote to reinstate that week extension for one more year to get through to next year's... amendments to the Bobcat Management Plan. The other one, again, is, as Mr. Bassett has alluded to, is the licensing, because there are other fur bearers on the wildlife management, and they're in need of managing also. So with that said, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? Okay, if not, we'll turn to the RAC for comments.
Leslie, why wasn't the extra week added for this year?
Because I have to go with the Bobcat Management Plan, which dictates what days the season can be within.
Bruce?
So I guess I don't understand. How was it added last year? Then?
Yeah.
They came through the public process and proposed that they actually proposed a two-week extension. And the board went with a compromise and gave them an extra week.
So that could happen again this year?
If the RAC and the boards chose to support that. There is one request, though, that I would make, and that would be that if you do recommend a change to the bobcat season, then I'd also have to add a week onto badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, and all of, and Martin to end on the same date, because we ran into problems this last year with people that were incidentally taking those other species, but the season was closed and they were trying to harvest bobcat.
So I have a follow-up question. When you presented that before, it seemed to me that DWR had been able to gain some valuable information regarding that right there. Is that a true impression I have, and is it valuable? Would it be valuable to have 2 years of that, if that's true?
Yeah, I think that the harvest would remain the same. It would hold true, and I've met with Mr. Fowden, and we've talked about making changes to the future Bobcat plan that does expire this coming year, and making changes to the season. But right now, for the division, we have to stick with the guidelines of the plan.
Craig?
Do you see any problems with those other species if you extend the season for them?
No. The biggest issue probably would be just first sale. The first sale does take place about that time. But I don't see any biological issue with extending the season by a week.
Any other comments from the rack? Chris.
I have a follow-up question rather than a comment. Okay to ask a question? Leslie, you're saying that the population dynamics of the bobcat can sustain extending the season again. The additional take in the mature toms does not negatively affect the population, but it's desirable for the trappers to be able to take the toms and the population can sustain it.
Yeah, because really where we need to make the adjustment probably is on the beginning of the season so that we're not taking almost as many females as we are males. So we'd rather see higher harvest on males later on in the season and fewer harvest to females in order to sustain the population longer or better.
So extending it for this past year was simply a Wildlife Board action based on a proposal that they received, and in order to do it again this year, it would be the same type of thing would have to happen because the plan is not due for update until next year.
Right, the plan expires in 2016, and I can't recommend seasons outside of the plan.
Outside of the plan.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Others? Other comments and or motions?
So I'd like to make one more comment. Yeah. That is, based on what you just said, it makes a lot of sense that if the board was to make a recommendation, that it would be a shift, not just an addition. And so that was a statement, but I would like to follow that up with, does that make any biological sense to you?
Yeah, probably what we'd be looking at in the future is maybe opening the season November 1st and closing it by the end of February in the future.
Chris.
Another follow-up question, if I may. If that season were extended once again for a week, for the trappers to be able to harvest more mature toms, and we also have to extend the season for all fur bearers because there are incidental takes of other species, can the other species, can their population dynamics absorb the difference of the take of the extended week?
I believe they could.
Okay. Any other comments and or a motion? Chris.
I would like to propose accepting the proposal with a modification to extend the fur bearer's harvest by 1 week.
Okay. Second, by Craig.
Can I clarify before you vote?
Please do, Leslie.
Okay, so beaver and mink would still end April 6th, and it's just those other species. Okay.
Just the ones that end on February 7th. Just the species that their season ends on February 7th.
Yes.
Okay, so the motion is by Chris and a second by Craig. Discussion on the motion. Bryce.
Going back to the other proposal about having a trapping license on the WMAs, could that be an amendment to the motion? You make that now.
So Chris, is that acceptable? Okay. So amend the motion to include a requirement for a fur bearer license. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that would be part of it anyway. So.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion? Okay, so the motion is to accept the plan as presented, with the exception to extend the fur bearer harvest for 1 week, including not only the lynx, but also, bobcat, but also badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel. Is that correct?
Yeah. No lynx.
No lynx.
No. Get me in trouble there.
Okay, so all in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Does that include
And the licensing. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Signify by saying aye and then raise your hand as well.
Aye.
Okay. All in favor. That's a unanimous, so no opposition. Okay. Rack, do we need a break for 5 or 10 minutes, or you want to push on?
Let's take a break.
Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break real quick. We'll start back at 4:15.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get started again. I wanted to recognize Byron Bateman, who's our wildlife board member representing the Northern Region. I failed to see you sitting over there. Thank you for coming. We're going to go ahead and get started with agenda item 8, presented by Nate Owens on the AIS rule amendments R657-60.
Thank you. I'm the aquatic invasive species biologist for the DWR here in the Northern Region. I'm relatively new to the region, so I haven't had an opportunity to meet many of you, but I look forward to interacting with you in the future. So I'm here to talk about modifications to rule R657-60, aquatic invasive species interdiction. Under this rule, currently all boats exiting infested water bodies or water bodies listed under this rule are required to undergo decontamination prior to being launched at any other water body within the state of Utah. As the rule is currently written, decontamination is defined in two different ways. The first is the clean, drain, dry method, which basically entails cleaning all mud, debris, and vegetation off the boat, draining the boat of all standing water, including any engine compartments that can hold water, and then having that boat be dry for a consecutive number of days, which varies depending on the season. Summer, that duration is 7 days. Spring and fall, that's 18 days. And in the winter, that's 30 days. The second option would be to have the boat professionally decontaminated by a trained and certified person, either from the DWR or state parks. And that entails undergoing a 140-degree wash on all exterior areas, flushing the engine compartment with 140-degree water, and all equipment, and then 120-degree flushes of all interior systems. Recently, we have found several instances where business owners would like to comply with this decontamination requirement, but the nature of their business basically doesn't allow them to do that. Specifically, we're talking about rafting companies on the Colorado River who ferry people up and down the Colorado several times a day using the same boats. Therefore, their boats can not undergo the required dry time, and they are also worried because those boats cannot withstand 140-degree temperatures either. So they're looking for a way to comply with the law, although the way it's currently written, that is impossible for them. The proposed modification would include an additional clause to this definition that would allow the DWR to issue a certificate of registration to a business owner, specifically when that business owner cannot reasonably decontaminate a boat undergoing these two other methods. So, for instance, rafting companies, they cannot use that hot water, so we would allow them to use an alternative form of decontamination to still comply with the law. The second rule modification revolves around changing the boundaries of what is considered Lake Powell. In 2013, when Lake Powell was officially designated in rule as an infested water body, the DWR was tasked with defining what exactly those boundaries are where people could and could not go before they needed a decontamination prior to launching elsewhere. So these were basically looking at the tributaries going into Lake Powell and determining where these point of no returns, so to speak, occur. On the Colorado River, originally that was determined to be at Spanish Bottom, which, if you can look at this map, the Spanish Bottom is located just below the confluence of the Green and Colorado Rivers, and this is where you could realistically take a jet boat down river to and still turn around and then zoom back up river. Below this is Cataract Canyon, which is most think is regarded as unnavigable going upriver. So that was the original delineation of the boundary. However, this poses one problem for the National Park Service because Spanish Bottom is actually located within Canyonlands National Park. Therefore, this would require the National Park Service to draft a quagga mussel management plan, despite there being no evidence that quagga mussels are present within the Canyonlands National Park boundaries. So we are proposing to move this boundary down 12 miles downstream to basically the boundary with the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. So if you're familiar with the area, just right a big drop rapids. Essentially, this would not change how we are approaching these boats, because any boat that goes down below Spanish Bottom ends up, if they go into Lake Powell, they will still need to be decontaminated. So our management plan would not change regarding these boats. However, a change in the boundary of Lake Powell would help the National Park Service avoid drafting a full management plan for quagga mussels, even though there are no quagga mussels that have been found within their boundaries. The third modification is concerning our inspection stations. Currently, we have inspection stations around the state, but the two primary ones that are operating right now are at Deer Creek Reservoir and the various ramps around Lake Powell. All exiting boats coming out of those two reservoirs are inspected by our technicians, make sure no attached mussels are on board. They're drained of all water, so all engine compartments are drained, all ballast tanks, live wells, anything like that is drained of water. And these boats are essentially starting the drying process. When those boats are inspected, our technicians are applying an orange seal, which you can see the types of seals up here. The orange one is not here because it's brand new this year, but you can see how these are attached. They're attached through the bow ring of the boat, and they secure the boat to the trailer. Now, the orange seals designate this boat as having come from a mussel-affected water body. So the only two water bodies where these are being applied in Utah are Lake Powell and Deer Creek. In addition to the seal, this self-certification form up here on the left is also given to the boater. On the bottom of this form, there's an inspection section and a decontamination section. So when an inspection is done, those technicians mark what exactly was inspected. Then they write the seal number that they applied to the boat, they date it, and then they provide their signature. The last part is that they actually stamp this in the lower right-hand corner with a site-specific stamp that's dated. So that's to basically prevent falsification of this document. When this boater shows up elsewhere and wants to launch anywhere else within the state, they need to present both the receipt, so this self-certification form, and this seal to the technician on the ramp, and that technician then determining what kind of boat it is, what was inspected, and the date that it started the dry time can determine whether that boat needs a decontamination or if the required dry time has been met. The modification to this rule would make it unlawful for any boater to destroy the receipt or the seal before showing up at the next water body and having that verified by a technician at that water body. And just to mention, we do have one other seal that we use within the state of Utah, and that's this blue seal here. The blue seal is applied to any boat that is professionally decontaminated, either by a DWR technician or a state parks technician. And likewise, the decontamination section of the self-certification form is also filled out, dated, signature, and then stamped with the date and the site where it was decontaminated.
Okay, thank you, Nate. Do we have any questions from the public? Robert.
Have you,
could you
Robert,
state
Robert your, Burns, Centerville, Utah. Yes. Mr. Chairman. Can the seal be removed after the decontamination time has expired?
Are you talking about the blue seal or
the orange
seal?
Orange seal.
No.
So have you thought about having any allowance for if the boat has to be removed from the trailer or it has to be inverted for storage?
Then that person can probably retain that orange seal. We haven't had anyone retain that orange seal and keep the receipt. If the orange seal is on there, they most of the times will not keep the receipt, or they just take the orange seal off and check it. So I suppose if they show up with the orange seal and can explain that they had to remove that, and they have the receipt that goes with that seal, I'm sure an exception can be made. But
so there currently is no allowance in the rule as written?
No,
to allow
there
that.
Is not.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Questions from the rack. Yeah, John.
I'm not a boater, but on the hot water cleansing, like how much time does that take?
That varies a lot by the boat type. A little John boat can take as little as 10 minutes, while some of these large cabin cruisers and wakeboard boats with 6 or 8 ballast tanks can take 1.5 to 2 hours.
And is there a cost to the boater then?
No, this is a free service.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
It sounds like a daunting task to try and enforce that law. My question is there a database that those hull numbers will be entered in and that if I'm putting my boat in Bear Lake, that they're going to check that hull number at Bear Lake to see if I've been in an infected water?
We are currently entering all this information into a database. All of our technicians around the state have an electronic tablet that they use to record all this data. Once that data is uploaded into the cloud, that data is accessible by anyone across the state that has that login information. So there have already been several instances this year where we've had a boater show up at one state park claiming that they had pulled out of Lake Powell 7 days ago. When we do the search on their bow number, we find that it was actually 3 days ago. So we do have that capability. We've had that capability for 2 years now, and it's progressing each year. So that is one way that we can verify whether that person is telling the truth or not.
One other question. How long has this tag system been in effect?
The orange seals have only gone into implementation this year. The blue seals have been implemented since the start of this program in 2007.
Okay.
You mentioned an alternative form of decontamination. What is that alternative form?
So one possible form of decontamination would be the use of bleach. So really, 3 to 5% bleach solution is effective against quagga mussel veligers or the larval form. this would probably have to be looked at each individual case-by-case basis. Bleach would be one possibility. Quaternary ammonium would be another one. Potassium chloride would be another one. We would really have to look at this case-by-case basis, figure out what the best science says, and then go from there. I guess the important thing is we're trying to bring a lot of these companies and businesses on board to help increase their compliance, and they want to do the right thing. They just aren't physically capable of doing that. And these are effective tools we can put in place that would help them comply with the law while also protecting our waters.
Any other questions? Chris.
I'm also interested in the alternative methods for the situation you describe, whitewater raft outfitters that do a lot of ferrying trips, and they may leave an infested water and arrive in an uninfested water on the same day. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned about the vagueness of what is in the works. It's not included in this plan, correct? I mean, we're
correct.
So we are looking for to propose an alternative means for those entities that can't, their equipment can't take the 140 degrees, and they cannot, you know, their business is not based on letting their boat dry for 30 days or whatever. And so that alternative is not yet formed.
No.
Has not yet been created, and yet they need fairly quick action on this, don't they?
Yes, I guess the point of all this is we need this language in the rule before they can present us with something that we can review and determine whether that is going to be sufficient or not.
What are they doing right now?
A lot of them are not decontaminating at all.
And there are there's no registration numbers necessarily on
not
their boats.
These
are not registered vessels.
No.
So there is a possibility that they are contaminating uncontaminated waters, and yet there's no rules for them to follow.
They're required to decontaminate.
Oh,
the problem is that is enforcing that down here in these canyons.
Okay. There are rules for them to follow, but they don't work for the nature of their business. That's the issue. That's why we're looking for an alternative, which they need in place pretty quickly.
They do. And these vessels honestly provide minimal risk.
Right.
They don't hold much water. They're not going to have attached muscles on board.
Right. So the issue is they need to be dried. They can't wait the amount of time. You know, they should not be transporting any water.
Correct. And they are good about that.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, comments from the public. I have one card from Robert Burns. Representing yourself?
Yes, I am. My comment would be that in the rule, there needs to be an allowance for someone to detach the orange tag without penalty. It could be a requirement that they could not enter a water again before the drying time has expired. But obviously for maintenance and for people who have smaller boats, that my boat is stored upside down. Take it off the trailer, flip it over, put it back on. There's no way I'm going to leave that tag on there and follow the law. So I would recommend there be some allowance in the rule that if the boat meets the decontamination requirements, that orange tag could be removed by the owner. Maybe they should still need to present it with the paper slip when they go to another body of water, but they could remove it if that time has expired. If the time hasn't expired and they removed it, they should be required to still go through a decontamination process, hot water. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? RAC, Matt.
Is the standard practice to basically cable the
boat to the trailer with the tag?
Yes.
Would it be acceptable just to put the tag on the boat? And just attach it to the haul ring or, you know, handle or something like that?
I guess it would be, except we've had quite a bit of non-compliance with people removing these. And then a lot of times we do our searching based on the seal number that we see. So if we know, it's an easy way for our technicians, when that person shows up, if they see that orange seal, say, this is a high-risk vessel. I need to search this for this inspection. I need to do a high-risk inspection, looking for any areas where the previous inspector did not inspect. I need to check on the dry time. If they don't automatically see that attached, a lot of times, if they're backed up, they will not search the inspections because it takes too long.
But do they, how big of a problem is the boat versus the trailer? You know, you're tying the boat to the trailer, and people may have issues with having to remove the boat from the trailer without putting it in the water again. If it was attached just to the boat and not the trailer, would that still meet the requirement?
Not necessarily, because then that means that boat could have launched several times before showing up at the next destination where it's checked by a technician. We have no way to verify that that boat has stayed on that trailer in the meantime.
Any other comments from the rack? If not, entertain a motion. Chris.
I would like to make one more comment.
Oh, go for it.
Let me assume that if you go on, you take a trip to Lake Powell, it may be a private trip, not outfitted, with friends, with family, a kayak expedition. You are still under the same rules because you are boating in infected waters and you could be transporting water or veligers out of that body of water.
Yes.
So no matter what, the contamination rules still apply. Even me and my 13-foot kayak. And so it would behoove us to have other methods of decontamination, not just for commercial entities, but everybody with, you know, lightweight boats that may not be trailered. So we're sort of in the learning phases of this decontamination thing. And as the rules develop, we realize we haven't yet set or described rules that accommodate all of the situations that might result in transporting, you know, infected waters away from those particular bodies of water. Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments? Motions?
Are you on, for her example, with the kayaks that are not trailered, are you attaching the seal just to the, how are you attaching the seal to those boats?
We don't encounter any kayaks or anything coming out of Lake Powell. It really has not been applicable to anything we've been doing. A lot of times at Deer Creek, if we encounter those and that person indicates that they have the intention of launching that kayak or paddleboard or whatever before the required dry time can be met, they do a quick hot water spray on that. But in general, our focus is mostly on the bigger boats that hold water and transport water. Those are the main vectors at which mussels are going to be transported from one water body to another.
Rice?
So you wouldn't have concern, I mean, so much that if we were to make a rule saying that people with the, well, boats in general can take them off if they take the orange stick or tag off after they've met their decontamination period, as long as they maybe kept it, because realistically the bigger boats, they're not coming off the trailers. It's the smaller ones, the ones that you're not as worried about.
Correct.
So, if you don't mind, Bryce. I'd like to make a motion that
please
we
do.
Pass, or as far as the rule amendment R657-60, that we pass, accept it as presented, with the exception that boat owners can remove the orange tag after the decontamination period, that they keep that orange tag and present it, I guess, next time they go to a body water with the reason why they did that. Is that acceptable?
Do you have a second? Okay, John, seconds. So, let's, I guess, clarify the motion. So you're suggesting accept as presented, with the exception that boat owners may remove their tag after the acceptable drying period or after other approved decontamination methods?
Let me, sort of amend that, because you don't necessarily have to wait for that drying period. If you have it professionally decontaminated tomorrow, you're not going to be waiting any period of time. So after the appropriate decontamination, whether it's an active action or it's a passive allow the time to expire, the tag should be removable. And then it has to be presented again with the certificate, right? Once you return to a new body of water.
Correct.
So you have to maintain the seal. If you remove the seal, you have to maintain it and represent it.
Yeah, Matt.
And one potential way around that is to say, if you had to remove the seal for storage to get the boat off the trailer, you could say that it had to remain at the storage facility, whatever it was, during the drying period. You couldn't be out running around with that boat with the seal off until the drying period had expired or you had had it decontaminated.
I have one question.
Yeah, Mike.
You don't mind. If we allow them to take the seal off, people lose things. Is there a penalty for not showing up with the seal? Is there fines? Is there ticketing? Is that a law enforcement issue at that point?
Yeah, that is a law enforcement issue. Sometimes we'll be able to look that record up and find out when the last date of contact was and where that was. A lot of times we will not be able to look that up, in which case, based on this rule change, that would be a law enforcement issue. Currently, we would just decontaminate that boat.
Thank you.
Okay. Is everybody, I guess we should probably restate the motion. Okay, so if I understand correctly, the motion at hand is to accept the presentation as presented, with the exception that boat owners, if necessary, may remove the tag after an acceptable dry time or acceptable methods of decontamination. Does that work
acceptable
for you, Bryce?
Yes.
And I think the second was John. Okay, any discussion on that? Bruce.
I don't want to belabor the point. I could see this myriad of enforcement issues, and I don't know how we can make that kind of recommendation without hearing from the enforcement side of things. I have more questions that are raised on the enforcement side.
We have some law enforcement officers in attendance here that may want to address.
That truly would belabor the point then, wouldn't it?
Maybe not. Would anybody all right.
Oh, darn it. They're saying darn it.
Brandon Barron with Northern Region Law Enforcement.
Can you put the microphone up? Thank you.
It's in my face that way. Brandon Barron with Northern Region Law Enforcement. So,
what's the clarification you'd like from us?
So the proposal before us is that we go ahead and allow the tag to be removed after there's no more quagga mussels on the boat. And what kind of implication is that for enforcement?
Really, all this is based off of people being honest, because they could dispose of that tag and the receipt. And if the system's not working right or they're out of service, we're not going to know anyways. So it's another tool for us to be able to use in the event that we do come across it. So I don't see any issues with it.
Will the database solve all that problem when you have a good database and a good computer system that you can...
It would help. We've had some issues with it.
We've had two cases already this year where the databases allowed us to verify that a boater has lied to us on entrance into a state park about coming from Lake Powell.
But anything when you're dealing with service issues, cell service or whatever, we're going to have problems. We got one right now we're trying to track down because it wasn't in there. We can't find it. So just use the tools the best we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion on the motion? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Well, it's unanimous. Okay. Number 9, youth fishing exemption rule amendments.
I guess I'm just doing the best I can.
Be presented by Rickles.
Okay, my name's Rick Olson. I'm with the Division of Law Enforcement Section. And trust me, these presentations will be a lot shorter than the biologists. We're just dealing with pretty simple rule changes here. So the first one I'm going to talk about is the Rule 657-45. It's the license exemption for youth organizations or school groups. Okay, Utah State statute created a program where certain youth can fish for free without a license. Groups such as Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, group homes for troubled youth. And part of that statute requires that the Wildlife Board adopt a rule specifying what that documentation is needed to do that. This proposal will satisfy that section in the code. The process that we're proposing will be done totally online. At the end of the a series of questions, the individual will be able to print out a form and have everything that he needs to take this group out. In the past, this is a little embarrassing to admit, but this statute went into effect several years ago. Nobody realized that we had that subsection in there that required the process to be part of the rule. So we've been doing a process, but we didn't have a rule to back it up. So the current process is you go online still, but you just print out a PDF and fill it out, and you take it with you. The division had no idea that this ever occurred, how many occurred. This new process will allow the division to track to see how many individuals are taking participating in this program. So they'll fill it out online. They will have to provide the name of the organization, the date and location of the activity, the approximate number of youth, and youth is defined as anyone under 16, and the name and the contact information for the group leader. The group leader must be at least 18 years old, must possess a valid Utah fishing or combination license. He must provide instruction and training to the youth on fishing laws and regulations. And he has to be sanctioned or approved by the school or the organization to do it. So in summary, we've already had an ongoing program. We're just modifying it a little bit and making it legal and changing the process so we will be able to track it and see how many people are taking or participating in the program. It gives a chance for volunteers to provide instruction, and we encourage youth to get involved with fishing. That's it.
All right. Thank you. Questions from the public? Rack. Questions? Craig.
How did you determine the age 16 or under?
That was set by the legislature in the code. In fact, it was just changed this last session. It was 14, and they upped it to 16.
Well, it kind of seems like maybe it ought to be under 18.
We'd have to talk to those really smart people that sit at the white building.
Like you're youth till you're 16, you're not adult till you're 18. So anyway.
Other questions? Chris?
Let me latch right onto that age bandwagon. Let's say you're 17. You're sort of stuck here. You're 17 years old and you're with the group. You're not a youth, so you can't be included in the permit, and you can't be the leader, so you have to have your own separate fishing license.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Those poor 17-year-olds.
Any other questions? Comments from the public? Comments from the RAC?
I really like this as a recruitment tool. I think this is an awesome way to get kids hooked on fishing, the outdoors. Kudos to this program. I just wanted to make that comment.
Any other comments and or motion?
Motion to approve.
Matt, who was the?
Is that a motion to approve?
Okay. Motion to approve by Matt, seconded by Bruce. Discussion. Craig?
Well, I'd like to amend it that goes for 18 or under, 17 or younger. Have that be part of our recommendation. Maybe it can't be amended, but I think that should be looked at.
Yeah, it can't. This group wouldn't have the authority to change that. That's set by the legislature in code.
So we need to talk to our representatives.
Can we give the legislature an action?
Okay, so the motion is to accept as presented, and of course, maybe we can make note that there is good reason to suggest to our representatives that be examined to include under 16 as well. Any discussion on the motion? Yeah.
So really, Bruce. What the suggestion is that you send a message to the legislature? I'm not sure that's part of this motion.
No, it's not part of the motion.
Okay.
We can note that.
Okay.
We can note that, pass it on to the division, and have their legislative liaison, Ben, bring it up.
There you go.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, all in favor? Any opposition? Okay, it's unanimous. Number 10, self-defense against animals and rules amendment. Rick Olson.
Okay, this proposal deals with R657-63, self-defense against wild animals. Okay, the purpose for these amendments are, in general, Utah laws relating to self-defense do not require a person does not have the duty to retreat from the threat. The current self-defense rule that we have in place now has provisions that a person has to safely retreat if possible. Okay, the way the rule and statute read right now is a person is justified in using force when that person has a reasonable belief that force is necessary to protect them or others from an imminent attack. A series of factors are listed in this rule to help define what is reasonable. One of those factors was, did you have the ability to safely retreat? We're proposing to change that to, did you have the ability to safely avoid the danger? The second amendment to this rule would be to add a line in the rule that states life and safety of a human is paramount to life and safety of a wild animal. And the third amendment would be a person is presumed to have acted reasonably if the wild animal enters a home, tent, camper, or other similar living structure occupied by the person, provided the wild animal is reasonably perceived to be capable of causing severe bodily injury or death to a human. So if a pika hops into your tent, you can't blast him. And the wild animal is killed while attempting to entering or occupying the structure. So if you got to your cabin and seen that a bear had been in it, but the bear isn't there anymore, you couldn't go on a bear hunt and be covered by this rule. So in summary, the reasonableness will be based in part on the ability to safely avoid the danger, not retreat. We'd add a line in there about safety of humans is paramount. And the wild animal entering a structure and reasonably perceived as able to cause injury or death would be able to be killed.
Okay, thank you.
And that's all to that one.
Questions from the public? Brack. Go ahead.
I'm just not sure I like the word severe. I don't think that, and I've dealt with, you know, this. I can take legal action or shoot a person that's going to cause severe injury. And the definition of severe injury to me is kind of ambiguous. Could it simply say injury? I don't know. It just caught me when I read that earlier today, and thought I don't know that I want to wait for an animal to severely injure me, just like I'm not sure I want to wait for a person to severely injure me. If they're going to injure me, I want to be able to feel like I can take some action.
I think the intent there was you don't have to wait for it to cause the injury. The animal has to be capable of causing severe injury. And you can, it is an ambiguous term, you know.
I can see that's a good explanation for it, where it says perceived to be able to cause severe injury. Okay.
So a garter snake, no. But a rattlesnake, yes. Okay, any other questions from the rack? Comments from the public? Comments and or motions from the rack?
Again, I'll motion to approve.
Okay, Matt, motion to approve as presented. Second by Bryce. Discussion on the motion. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's unanimous. Number 11, possession of firearms rule amendments, waterfowl and upland game. Yes.
Okay, this amendment amends the upland game and the waterfowl rule are 6, 5, 7, and 9. Okay, the purpose of this proposal is to bring the division's administrative rules in line with the Utah state firearm laws passed by the legislature. We fully recognize and support an individual's right to possess firearms. And I think this picture was taken at Farmington Bay on opening day. Back when Justin was the manager. Okay, the current version of the upland game and the waterfowl rule have a provision that limits an individual's possession of firearms. We're proposing to change that to just define when an individual can discharge those firearms. And one important part to make about this proposal, this only applies to WMAs that are listed in either the Upland Game Guidebook or the Waterfowl Guidebook. So, for example, up here, they wouldn't pertain to the Brigham Face or to Middle Fork, any of our more mountainous WMAs. So the discharge of those weapons would be restricted to a legal weapon during the open season for lawful hunting purposes, or as authorized by a COR or similar document, or for a lawful purpose of self-defense. So in summary, this just changes the upland game and waterfowl rules to ensure they're consistent with Utah firearms laws. We would restrict the discharge of firearms on specified WMAs to legal weapons during the open season for lawful hunting purposes, as authorized by a COR or for the lawful purpose of self-defense.
Thank you. Questions from the public? Questions from the rack? Comments from the public?
Questions?
Go ahead, Craig.
Does this affect concealed weapons? Concealed weapon permits? Concealed weapon permits?
This would apply to everybody. You could possess any weapon that you wanted to. You just couldn't discharge it unless it met those requirements. Now, the concealed weapon portion of the law could come in. If you're going to carry a pistol that is concealed on one of these properties, you would still have to have a concealed carry permit for that.
Any other questions from the rack? Comments from the public? Comments from the rack and or motion? Chris?
I move that we accept the possession of firearms rule amendments proposal as written.
Any second? Second by Craig. Discussion? Okay. All in favor? Signify by saying aye and
aye.
Aye.
No opposed? Unanimous. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Last item on the agenda is the fee schedule, and Justin Dalling will be presenting that.
And Justin is going to beat me in brevity.
So my name is Justin Dolan, and I'm presenting this this recommendation for Kenny Johnson, who felt like he didn't need to come to all the racks for this short little presentation. But essentially, the division does not have a recommendation to adjust the fee schedule for fiscal year 2016. And that's the presentation.
Okay, questions from the public? Robert, do you have a question or...
Yes, I do. Mr. Administrative Services Personnel. Since Kenny dumped it on you. I guess there's no intention to establish a fee for multi-season deer tags.
Not at this time. We did the multi-season for combo and fishing and hunting, but at this time, no, not for...
But those are just combination permits for right. multiple years.
Right.
Not for multiple... Well, yeah, okay. So, and then it doesn't appear he adjusted the fee schedule changing elk premium to multi-season combo or multi-season. So under elk resident and non-resident, he still has premium limited entry bull.
So there's elk resident archery is 50.
Right, go down past Cooperative Wildlife Management Unit, you get down to Premium Limited Entry Bull.
And your question is, why wasn't that changed, or why wasn't that dropped in the fee schedule?
It doesn't appear it's been changed to multi-season limited entry
bull. Oh, based on the new language?
That was passed
yeah.
with the...
Good point, Robert. We probably missed that one.
Okay.
I mean, the title of that needs to be changed to reflect the what we're calling that hunt.
Okay.
And I don't know, to be honest, I don't know if we can change the title without going through the legislature or not.
I'll have a comment during the comment section.
Okay.
Okay, questions from the rack. Comments?
Robert Burns again. My comment would be that do need to change multi-season on the premium limited entry bull. We did change that with the rule changes last November, I believe. So, and then the division did opt not to implement a increased fee for multi-season deer limited entry premium and regular limited entry last year, and again they're opting not to change that again this year. So we established that hunt last November, and we'll be having a multi-season deer hunt on limited entry and premium limited entry units this year, but those people are only paying the price of a regular limited entry and premium limited entry tag. Okay, so how we did it for bulls before, it's about 1.8 times what a regular tag is. But the division hasn't opted to do that. Probably the number of tags is fairly limited, but we should probably ask the division to establish that permit price at a reasonable level compared to what we're doing with elk. So I would recommend that you push that recommendation up to the Wildlife Board, and maybe the division will carry it to the legislature this year for changes to the 2016, I believe, permit prices. Thank you.
Okay. Comments from the RAC and or motion?
So it doesn't take the legislature to change the fee. Is that true?
Well, the division's required to take any kind of change in fee through the public process, the RAC and the board.
Sure.
And then eventually present that to the legislature, who ultimately approves that new fee structure.
Okay, so that is a normal process to go to the board with that recommendation.
Correct. I guess I'm not crystal clear, Robert, as to your recommendation. We now have a multi-season hunt, which we used to call a premium limited entry hunt.
So there's two components. The elk that's called premium in here, premium limited entry, we changed that to multi-season limited entry. And then there is a deer component where we have not established an increased fee for the multi-season limited entry, premium limited entry that we have now created.
But we never had a premium limited entry deer hunt. We had elk hunts, but we didn't have deer hunts.
Yeah, the confusion was we called multi-season elk limited entry elk hunts premium. And then we had limited entry deer units, and we had premium limited entry deer units. So we couldn't call the new multi-season deer a premium tag. It was just confusing. So the Mule Deer Committee and then the division and their recommendation in the changes we made last November, the elk is no longer called premium limited entry. It's called multi-season, and now we have in deer we have limited entry and we have premium limited entry units, and we have multi-season tags on both of those.
Okay, I think I'm following now.
Yeah.
Comments, other comments and or motion? Anyone? Please.
I would like somebody else to try that.
I would motion to accept with the recommendation to have the fee increase match the percentage for the existing elk tags.
Accept as presented and have the multi-season
deer
fees be reassessed to, or
so that the deer the multi-season deer tag is a higher fee similar to the multi-season elk tags.
Okay. We have a second. Craig, second. Discussion.
So I have a question on that. So do we actually charge more for multi-season elk right now?
We do, just like the premium. Yeah, 1.8 times like Robert
okay.
said.
So then that is the correct motion then, because it's really only the deer multi-season that isn't adjusted.
Yeah, so the deer needs to reflect what we've done on the elk.
Got it.
But in addition, we don't call out a multi-season elk. So there needs to be a title change there.
Correct.
It's currently premium limited entry.
Is that a typo?
It's not a typo, because we used to call it a premium limited entry elk, and now we're calling it a multi-season limited entry elk. So we've just changed the word premium to multi-season, but it's not reflected in the heading of that particular fee.
So there could be a requested amendment to the motion to add the language to clarify the elk multi-season tag. Okay, so then I do make that recommendation to amend the motion.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Kevin.
I think that the name change or the title change is an administrative process. It's not part of the motion. It has nothing to do with the fee. We're looking at the fee schedule, not the name of the or the title of the permit. I think that administratively they can make the change to the permit. I don't know that it should be a part of the motion.
What do you think, Justin?
I'm not sure on the answer on that. So to be on the safe side, I would recommend that the motion includes that. And if it's just an administrative thing, we can deal with that as it moves forward.
Any other comments? Okay.
So what I have, help me with the wording here, accept the presentation as presented with additions or modifications.
I think it's a recommendation.
With an exception to the multi-season deer fees, in that they are in line or match the multi-season elk fees. Does that work? Any other suggestions? Okay. And clarify the elk multi-season name change. Okay? Everybody happy? Okay. Any discussion on that? I think we already did discuss that. All right. All in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. It's unanimous. I need to have a motion to dismiss, adjourn. Russ?
I'll motion that we dismiss this meeting.
Second. Second. Aye. Bryce, meeting adjourned. Thank you. I'm not right.